Call a meeting to order. This is State Government Finance Committee meeting for Thursday, February 3rd, 2011. And since we do have a quorum, would someone move the minutes from our meeting of yesterday, February 2nd? Representative Erdahl moves those minutes. If you would do some speed reading and any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor of those minutes signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, motion carried. Well, first off, we're picking up our discussion about pensions, and we have asked the folks who didn't get to finish their presentation here a week or so ago to come back, and so we'd like, I don't know who wants to go first, if you all three are going to come up together. Have you drawn straws as to who goes first? All right, Mary Vanek is Executive Director of PERA. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. If you have your presentation material from the last time we were here, PERA picks up on page 12.
Maybe better give us a half a second here to dig that out.
Which one is it?
Are they in the new packet?
We have their additional handouts if you need them.
They're in your packet for today, then, folks. You were saying page 12?
Page 12.
Okay. Everybody found your material? Okay, proceed.
Okay, thank you. The Public Employees Retirement Association has been around since 1931 when the legislature created this retirement program for city, county, and non-teaching school district employees. We are governed by an 11-member board of trustees, five of whom are elected. Three are elected to represent our larger general plan, one police and fire, and one to represent the benefit recipients, the retirees. The state auditor or a designee of the state auditor is on our board by statute, and we have five members who are appointed by the governor, one to represent cities, one counties, one school districts, one the general public, and an additional member appointed to represent our retirees and other benefit recipients. We meet about every other month and schedule meetings when there are other issues that need to be addressed. We currently, as of June 30th, we have over almost $17 billion in assets under management. And we do govern four defined benefit plans and one defined contribution plan for local government elected officials. And we'll describe on the next page who the numbers and who participates in those plans. On page 13, you can see, or slide 13, you can see that our general plan as of June 30th had over $11 billion in assets. We have approximately 140,000 active participants in that plan, 68,500 benefit recipients, and about 45,000 people who have left the system, earned a right to a pension, and when they meet the eligibility age, a minimum of 55, can apply to start collecting their pension from us. Our police and fire plan as of June 30th had a little over $4 billion in assets. There are 11,000 law enforcement and salaried firefighter personnel throughout the cities and counties in the state who participate in this program. There are 7,500 benefit recipients, and again, another 1,300 folks who have left the system and will be eligible for a benefit when they reach retirement age. The correctional plan was newly created by the legislature in 1999. This is a plan that provides benefit coverage for correctional guards in the local county jails. So we have a membership in that plan, about 3,500 people. And because it was just created in 1999, there are only a little over 400 benefit recipients in that plan at this time. And again, there are a number of inactives who will eventually be entitled to a benefit. Our defined contribution plan was created in 1990 or 91. It is primarily for local government elected officials, so the school board members, mayors, city council members, county commissioners can participate in this plan. It is a defined contribution plan as it's described, and it's a 5% contribution by the individuals, 5% by the local units of government, and they choose how to invest their funds through the options available in the State Board of Investment supplemental accounts. There are about 4,500 active participants, but in total there are over 7,200 accounts that we are still managing for people who have left local government positions and have left their money with the system. The legislature assigned to us in last year's pension bill administration of the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund. And that is a separate account maintained under our umbrella of accounts or funds that we manage. There are $844 million in assets in that account right now, 143 active members as of the end of the fiscal year, June 30th, and about 4,300 benefit recipients. We also were given 2 years ago responsibility for administering a statewide voluntary plan for volunteer fire relief associations. And this is a statewide program that pays a menu of little higher benefits for many of the relief associations out there. Their assets would be invested in an account or supplemental account maintained by the State Board of Investments. And thus far, we have 18 relief associations who have chosen to join that plan. They can only enter on January 1st, the beginning of a new year, so it has been a slow start, but just in the last month of January 2011, staff has gone out and spoken to five other relief associations that are interested in joining this plan. So we expected a slow start. The folks who were really interested in getting this plan in place anticipated that there would be roughly 200 of the 700 local relief associations that could benefit by having us administer their programs for them. But it is a voluntary basis. It requires support by the local unit of government who sponsors the relief association and the members of those volunteer firefighters. So it is nothing that is foisted upon anybody unless they choose to go into that program. And then the other thing I wanted to mention is that I think it was 3 years ago or 4 years ago, time is flying, the legislature asked PERA to be the record keeper for other post-employment benefit accounts for local units of government to set aside money to fund their retiree health care and to ask the State Board of Investment to invest those accounts. And currently we are keeping records for 19 separate OPEB accounts. To get to our funding picture, for some of you, we visit some of you individually, and we spoke primarily of just our general plan. That is our largest plan. And today I'm going to cover our three main defined benefit plans. Our general plan, as you can see, the funding on an actuarial basis, where we smooth the recognition of gains and losses in investments that depart from our expected 8.5% return. So our actuarial value has remained fairly steady over the last 4 years. We've gone from 73.3% funded in 2007 to 76.4% funded in 2010. On a market value basis, in 2007, we were a little over 77% funded. And while I don't show it here, the actuarial report showed that our contributions were right where we needed them to be so that we would get back to 100% funded, get up to 100% funded by 2031. Then the market hit in 2008 and 2009, and eroded our market value, actual assets on hand compared to our expected liabilities, to 53.8% in 2009, but with the passage of the reform bill last year and better returns in 2010, our market value in that plan has rebounded to 66% in that 1 year. The contribution history of PERA general plan is another interesting story, and I won't go into detail about it, but I can tell you that in 1984, when that employer rate dropped, it was believed at that time that we were moving in such a positive way toward 100% funding that there was no reason why our contribution rate by employers couldn't be lowered. And there were a number of other things that happened that year to change how we accounted for our plans. But if you think about where we are today on an actuarial basis at 76% funded, we were only 78% funded in 1984 when the decision was made to lower the employer contributions into our plan. We believe that that is a good part of the reason why we never got to 100% when our sister systems did. We got to 90% in 1999 because of the strong markets, but we had to deal with the fact that we needed to increase contributions, and the legislature did that in 2001 and again in 2005, and in 2010 we asked for another slight increase. And that's why you see that our contributions have slowly increased. Since 1997, it was an increase to account for a benefit bill that passed that year, and thereafter to deal with the projections by the actuary that we needed more revenue to get to 100% funding. On average, our employee contribution rates are higher than other systems that are comparable to ours. We're asking our employees to pay 6.25%. Similar systems employees pay 5% across the country. Our employer contributions in this plan still remain lower than the national average. We're collecting 7.25%, and across the country it's more like 9%. So our contributions are higher than MSRF's general plan that has comparable benefits, but there is a history as to why that's necessary. The current information from the actuary tells us, however, that we are on track with these rates to get to 100% funding by 2031, which is required by state statute. The next page.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Vanek, on page 14, the market value.
Representative Murphy, would you use your mic there, please?
The market value, on page 14, the market value is the 2010 percentage. Is that for June 31st or June 31st? Do you have a figure of what it would estimated at December 31st?
Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, 66% is as of June 30th. We have done a rough estimate of what our liabilities would have grown to through December 31st and what the market return on our assets have done for us, and have calculated an estimate that we'd be about 75% funded as of the end of December.
Thank you.
You may proceed.
On page 15 is a little history of our police and fire fund. That plan, again, on an actuarial basis, has maintained a pretty level funded ratio, roughly 92% in 2007 and back to 87% in 2010. But on a market value basis on the right-hand side, you can see that it dropped pretty significantly as a result of the decline in the asset values. At 97.5% funded in 2007, we were close to getting back to 100%, but with the market drop in 08 and 09, it declined to about 64%, and we gained back almost about 10% in the last year. That contribution rate history was set at what was anticipated to be the cost of the benefits. So the benefits that people were earning were roughly 20% of their salaries. And in state law, it requires that that cost, that contribution needed to pay those benefits, is to be shared, 40% of it paid by the employees and 60% of it paid by the employers. So for years, we were collecting 8% from members and 12% from employers. That fund got very well funded because it was adequately funded from day one, and there were other revenues flowing into that plan. So by 1994, a decision was made to slightly lower the contributions because we had over 100% of the assets in the plan that were needed to fund benefits. So we were over 100% funded. By 1999, that plan, or 1998 was the measure that plan was 134% funded. State law at the time said that we were supposed to lower our contributions down to erase any extra contributions we were collecting. We were collecting 19% of pay between members and employers at that time. We would have had to lower our rates to 11.4% to wipe out the excess contributions coming in, with the idea that the extra money, the 34% extra assets, would then pay for the rest of the cost of the benefits. Well, in working with the legislature, we didn't take it down that far, but we took it down to 15.5%. So members were paying 6.2% and employers were paying 9.3%. We were collecting 15.5% of the salaries of the members contributing to the plan to pay for a benefit that they were earning each year that cost us 20% and rose to 22% by 2003. So the contributions we were collecting were less than what we needed to fund those police officers and firefighters' benefits that they were earning each year. And we were using the extra money, the 34 down to 26 down to 24% extra assets above 100%, to help pay for that difference in cost. So we were spending down the savings account, so to speak, at the time that the market eroded the value of those assets during the dot-com bubble and then recently in the 2008 and 2009 recession. So you can see that the contributions have increased above our traditional 8 and 12%. We are now at 9.6 by the member and 14.4 by the employer, and that plan will need to be reviewed again within the next year to figure out what more we need to do to address its movement to get to 100% funded by 2038, the date designated by the legislature for us to have 100% of the assets to meet 100% of the liabilities. I did a little back of the envelope calculation based on information that I had available to me compared to other police and fire plans in other states, and the accounts that I looked at, I can tell you that it appears that there was an average employee contribution in other states for law enforcement and police and fire account fire plans of 8.7% and by the employer of 18.3%. Just to give you some idea of how we compare. Okay? And then finally, the correctional plan that you created in 1999 has a very favorable story. It's been adequately funded in terms of the contributions collected from the members and the employers since it was created in 1999. On an actuarial basis, it has stayed very close to 100% funded. On a market value basis, it was over 100% funded in 2007. And even after the market decline in 08 and 09, it has rebounded to close to 85% funded on a market value basis. The actuary tells us that the contributions that were set in law in 1999 at 5.83% from the members and 8.75% from the employers are sufficient to fund this plan and get it to 100% funding when it's required to be there. That is the paraplan overview. On the next page, we want to just recap for you what the 2010 legislation did to modify benefits and lower our obligations, our unfunded liabilities. In the general plan, we lowered the annual retirement adjustment paid to our benefit recipients from 2.5% to 1% until we get back to 90% funded. In the police and fire plan, they're receiving 1% this year and 1% next year, and beginning in 2013, their annual adjustment will be whatever inflation is, up to a cap of 1.5% until they get back to 90% funded. And the correctional plan, those benefit recipients will receive 1% each year until they get back to 90% funded, and then it will go back to 2.5%. That plan is probably going to get there within the next 5 years at the current level of earnings and reduction in liabilities. But we'll be discussing that with the Pension Commission so that we can forecast that adequately in advance. For those members who have left the system and have a benefit waiting to be paid, current law gives them 3% interest on that monthly benefit until they get to 55 and 5% thereafter until they start to collect. We lowered the interest we pay on the value of that benefit to 1% beginning January 1st, 2012. And for our current working members covered by PERA who leave the system after this calendar year, they will receive no interest on the growth of that pension. Whatever they earn as of the date that they leave, that's what they will be entitled to when they apply to collect their benefit. We slightly increased contributions for our general plan, 0.25% for employees and 0.25% for employers. For the employers, that was roughly $12.5 million in additional cost across our 2,200 participating employers in that plan. In the police and fire plan, we also increased rates again slightly to 0.2% for members, 0.3% for employers. Again, that shows the 40-60 split. And the correctional plan needed no additional contributions. We lowered vesting, we talk about lowering so many things. We increased vesting. For anybody enrolled in the plan as of July 1st, 2010, new members will have to have 5 years of service credit before they qualify for a benefit. Since 1989, all plans in the three statewide systems have only needed 3 years. So we increased that, and that was actually a suggestion by our participants who are represented by AFSCME and SEIU. They thought it was appropriate to increase the level of vesting. We don't get any savings from that till the out years because it only applies to new enrollees in the plan, but eventually that will roll into showing a reduction in our contribution needs. In the police and fire plan, again, and the correctional, this came from the membership. They said we're career employees. We don't need 3 years to vest. So vesting has been changed to 50% vested after 5 years of participation for those enrolled as of July 1st, 2010, gradually going up to 100% vested after they have earned 10 years of service in the plan. So that will show a savings down the road also. Our refund interest in all our plans for all three statewide systems, if somebody withdraws and wants to take out their contributions, since 1989 they've received 6% interest compounded annually on that lump sum just withdrawal. We've lowered that to 4% beginning July 1st of this year. As a result of the modifications made in the 2010 bill, we were able to reduce the unfunded liability, the portion of our liabilities that we know we need to fund going forward, by $2.8 billion in our general plan, $625 million in our police and fire plan, and $15 million in our correctional plan. That's my portion.
Representative Leidinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. What is the process used to change those contribution rates? How do we do that? Just briefly.
Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the actuary annually prepares a report to tell us what our contribution needs are to fund our plans to reach the full funding date established by the legislature. And if those contributions are, historically, if they were lower than what we needed or greater than what we needed, it was really a decision by the legislature with input from our boards on whether or not those rates should be adjusted at any particular time. We sought increases in 2001, which again was a difficult period because of the dot-com bubble.
Right.
So we got a slight increase at that time, but not enough to fund us, so we had to come back to the legislature a few years later, and then in 2005 we got more contribution into the plan. We got approval to increase them. Also,
you do that.
However, in 2005, the legislature did add language to the Paris statute. We were the first ones, and now the other systems have done the same. But we did add language that says our board can adjust those rates within certain increments, like 0.25% each for the employee and employer, or if it's a serious deficiency, 0.5% each. So we get our valuation. Our year ends June 30th. We get our valuation in December. If we need to raise rates in the future or lower them, we make a recommendation. And if the legislature does not change our recommendation during the session that follows the end of that calendar year, the following July 1st, we will automatically implement an adjustment on our rates, either upward or downward, if we are collecting more than what we need. We have not had an opportunity nor a need to exercise that yet. I don't see any opportunity or need to exercise that for a couple of years. We have to wait till everything settles down as a result of the rebound in the market and the law change last year to see where we really end up. But yes, the legislature gave us authority for our boards to establish those rates in the future within certain parameters, but the legislature does have a session in between the time we make a recommendation and implement it to evaluate whether our recommendation should be implemented.
Thank you for that answer.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Vanek, I'm just looking at the ratios of employer contributions versus employee. Seems like it's always employer pays more. I'm just curious, is that always true? And historically, is that always true? The employer always pays a much greater percentage than the employee?
Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, it's not always true. Minnesota's plans were set up at one point where the employer paid a little more to pay off the unfunded part of the plan, because the employer's the constant. The members come in and out, but the employer is the constant participant. So typically, the employer rate was set a little higher. But as Ms. Hacking will explain to you, and Dave Bergstrom could tell you, that when their plans got to 100% funded, that additional contribution, that higher amount paid by the employer, was either reduced or eliminated because they didn't have an unfunded portion to pay off anymore. So then the member and employer contributions were equalized. PERA hasn't gotten to 100% funded, so we're still collecting a little bit more, 1% more in salaries from our general plan participating employers than we do from our members. And as I mentioned earlier, in the police and fire plan and in the correctional plan, it is set in state statute that whatever the contribution is that's needed to come into the plan, it will be shared, 40% of it paid by the member and 60% of it paid by the employer. And that is a policy statement written in statute.
Thank you.
Representative Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Vanek, when you talk about employer contributions in excess of 9%, you're looking at comparisons. Are you looking at other public employee-type plans across the country, or are you including private and public in that number?
Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we took that information from a study that was done on public sector plans that are comparable to ours, which mean that their employees are also participating in Social Security as our employees are. So it is a comparison to other public sector plans similar to ours in the country.
Representative Murray.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Vanek, have you done any comparison against the private sector then in that same regard?
Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe you have in your packets, we sent this, Mr. Marble, did you get this handout, answers to questions that were raised before? Okay, well, we'll make sure it gets to you. We did look at a study that shows what typically the contribution is that's made to a 401k by private sector employees or employers. And the survey showed that most private sector employer matching contributions were 50% of whatever the employee is making, up to 6%, so a 3% contribution. And the employer's contribution to profit sharing represents another 4.7% of compensation. So it's roughly 7.7%, around 8%, that an employer is contributing in the private sector in the 401k profit sharing models that we have seen in a study that we referred to.
Representative Murray.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Vanek, if possible, I'd like to see that study and just see where those numbers are coming from, just out of curiosity. And then on the police and fire, I understand that they're not subject to Social Security, correct? And then so the contribution has to be a little higher to the plan. Just out of curiosity, in Social Security, if you become disabled, you get benefits from Social Security, SSDI. If a policeman or a fireman become disabled, not in the line of duty, is there such a benefit coming out of this plan too, or is there some supplemental type plan for that?
Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the police and fire plan has two different levels of benefits. So if you are injured and become disabled and unable to perform your job as a result of an injury in the line of duty, there's one threshold of benefits, and there's a lower threshold of benefits paid if you are injured and unable to perform your job, but it's outside your job activity. So, yes, there are benefits payable, but we distinguish in the level of benefit payable by what caused the injury that prevents you from working.
Thank you.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The list that you referenced regarding the number of plans that have a higher contribution rate, my interest is, I guess, in finding out if we're going to use those for comparisons, how are they doing to the contribution, and are they are fully funded, and what states are they? I mean, California, New Jersey. I guess my interest is in... We're not at the top in terms of a contribution rates, but I'd like to know how they are doing in terms of performance against ours in terms of being funded and which states those are.
Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, we do have the detail associated with that based on the study to which we took the information, and we will make that available to you.
Thank you.
Representative Stansrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Vanek, you mentioned a comparison against private industry of 401k plans that had profit sharing, and then it showed a greater percentage given by the employer when you combine those two numbers. I don't know the answer to the question. I'm curious. I've never been in a company where there was actually profit sharing, but many of them offered a 401k plan, but not very many offered a profit sharing plan. What percentage of the private working folks are actually have access to a profit-sharing sort of retirement plan? Because I'm just wondering if that's a fair comparison to the general population.
Laurie Hacking with TRA. the information that we're giving you is from an annual benchmarking survey that's done by Deloitte in Consulting and the International Foundation of Employee Benefit Plans. So this isn't our information. It's based on this benchmarking study. But to your question, their survey showed that 59% of private sector employers paid matching contributions into 401k plans. Only 5% paid profit sharing, which I think is your question. But then 27% of employers paid both matching contributions and profit sharing in contributions. So it's those are the percentages we have. And the report, which we can get you a copy of, is fairly thick. It's a good source of information for all those kinds of questions.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ms. Vanek, for coming back and answering our questions. And Ms. Hacking, do you want to proceed with your portion?
Thank you. I'm working from slide 18, Teachers Retirement Association. Like the other two systems, we've been around a very long time, well over 80 years. We predate, actually, Social Security. We cover all K through 12 public teachers and administrators except for the cities of Duluth and St. Paul, which are in separate funds. We also cover charter school teachers and some state university and community college faculty. We are governed by an 8-member board of trustees, 4 of them elected from active members, 1 from retirees. We have 3 statutory appointments made by the Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget, the Commissioner of Education, and also the Minnesota School Boards Association has a seat on our board. You can see our basic plan information there. As of the end of fiscal 2010, our assets stood at $14.9 billion. I can report that today that it's a lot higher. We are up about $2 billion over that amount, standing at about $16.8 billion. We have an active contributing members of 77,356, benefit recipients of nearly 52,000, and deferred vested members of 12,756. So those are our basic statistics. On page 19, you see our funding history. Mary clearly explained the difference between actuarial value and market value, the actuarial value being the smoothed values. And you can see from 2007 through 2009, we did go from 87.5% on an actuarial basis down to 78.5%. So again, the markets had a pretty good negative impact on us. But looking at it from a market value perspective, in 2007, we were almost 93% funded. So not quite at 100%, but a very good portion of the way there. But the market downturn in 08 and 09 hit us severely. We were under 60% in 2009. Since then, because of the benefit reform package that was enacted last year, we are back. We've recovered somewhat to 67.6, and again, if it were measured today, we would be close to 74% funded. So there has been very considerable comeback of the fund. We are not out of the woods yet. We still have a ways to go in terms of improving our funding, but we've certainly in 1 year made a very big big improvement, and thanks really to the benefit reform package that was enacted last year. The bottom of this page shows a kind of somewhat different contribution rate history than what you saw for MSRS and PARA. Back in the 1980s, well, let me just say that the red line is the employer contribution rate and the blue line is the employee. And what you can see there is that for a good portion of the decade of the 1980s and 1990s, the employer contribution rate into TRA was quite a bit higher than it is today, and certainly than it was for the employee rate. And what was happening back then is that TRA was experiencing funding problems. And the legislature did address that by increasing the employer rate, and it actually hovered between 8 and 9% for most of the 1980s and 1990s. Now, the good news of that was because those contributions came in and because there were excellent investment returns, particularly in the latter half of the 1990s, we got to 100% funded much sooner than was anticipated. We hit that mark in 1997, 98, and as a result, same mechanism that Mary described with respect to PARA, the contribution rates were dropped dramatically for both employer and employee. The employer rate dropped from a little over 8%, just slightly under 8% to 5%, and the employee rate dropped from 6.5% to 5 as well. And it was at that point felt that we didn't need that extra money because we had attained full funding. In fact, we were 105%, 106% funded for that period. So we are at a point now, unfortunately, because of the downturn in the markets that occurred in 08 and 09 and also in 01 and 02, that we've had some setbacks and we need to look at those contribution rates again. And the law that was passed last year will see a gradual increase in those rates starting this year for both employee and employer commensurately over the next 4 years. But again, to emphasize, compared to the national averages, the employer rate nationwide for public employee plans are 9.4%, and it's 5% for employees. So our employer rate is still considerably lower than the national average, and our employee rate is going to be actually higher. The next page, 20, just goes over the benefit reform changes. Some of them are similar to what PARA and MSRS did. For post-retirement increases, here we actually differed a bit. TRA took a little more dramatic approach because our funding needs were more significant. There is a temporary two-year freeze in our annual increase. There was no increase paid in January of this year, 2010, and there'll be no increase to retirees in January 2011. After that point, we go to 2% and we'll remain there until we are 90% funded. And as was said earlier, we expect that will take many, many years to get to 90% funded. The deferred augmentation, we similarly brought in line with our annual retiree increases. That will be 2% going forward, lowered from 3 and 5%, as Mary described. Contribution rate increases, as I said earlier, we are going to go from 5.5% where we are now, gradually to 7.5 over the next 4 years in stair steps of 0.5% per year. Vesting, we made no change in that. It remains three-year vesting for TRA, and our refund interest rate dropped from 6 to 4% as with the other plans. All told, this benefit package reduced our liabilities by $1.75 billion, so a very significant amount of money. The next page just kind of sums up the impact of the 2010 pension bill in terms of the lowering of liabilities. You can see what we showed you piecemeal before of the savings for each plan as a result of the bill. And all told, it came up to just shy of $6 billion in savings for the plans. And again, this was extremely critical to getting all of our plans back on better financial footing and improved. This was not a small reduction in liabilities. Across all the plans, it averaged about 10 to 12% of reduction in our liabilities. So this was fairly significant. And I would also point out, unlike other states, and which I'm about to speak to in a minute, in Minnesota, we were one of the few plans that reduced liabilities for both current retirees and current active members. You'll notice that in other states, the tendency would be to enact reforms and cuts, but only affect newly hired employees. And while that saves money, those savings don't accrue until 30 to 40 years out, whereas the way we have structured our plan, because of our funding needs, we are garnering those savings very quickly, immediately, and starting this year.
Ms. Hacking, to this point of the 5.9 plus billion in reductions or costs, could you give us the total numbers before and after of the liabilities of funds before and after?
Yes, I don't have that right here. It would have been in Mr. Martin's material, but we can get that back to back to you. I don't have all the numbers, but if you're looking for a relationship, it was our liabilities today, depending upon the plan, are roughly 10 to 11% lower than they were prior to the 2010 bill, but we'll get you the detail on that.
Okay, thank you.
Page 22, I believe the committee asked what's going on in other states, and the short answer is a lot's going on in other states. We tried to just give you a grid here, and there are a lot of states, but a lot of states have looked to do similar things to what we did in terms of looking at contribution rates and benefit changes. There were a number of states which increased contributions for employees. And I might point out some of these states. I'll give you a couple examples. Missouri, Missouri and Virginia had no contributions coming in from employees. And so as a result of their reforms, newly hired employees, not existing, but newly hired employees will be paying, in Missouri's case, 4% contribution rate. In Virginia, 5% contribution rate. Another example, a little bit in the middle, is New York. They had a contribution rate for employees of 3% of pay, but only for the first 10 years of service. After 10 years, the employee was not contributing anymore. So again, for new hires, that will change. It's going to be 3% for their entire career. So those are just a couple of examples, and you know, states vary all over the place in terms of their contribution rates. And I apologize that you didn't get this handout distributed, but we'll make sure. We actually have a list here from the survey that shows every state's contribution rates for their employees and employers, so you can see the full information. A lot of states also looked at increasing contributions for employers, and those are listed there. In some of those states, those increases happen automatically. In other states, it's in statute, like here at in Minnesota. A few states looked also at changing their cost of living adjustments. Again, a lot of these did it for new hires, but there are three states, Minnesota, Colorado, South Dakota, which did it for current retirees. And as I'm going to describe in a minute, we're all facing a lawsuit with respect to that. So they're listed there, that the states which changed their annual adjustment for retirees. Plan design changes, a lot of changes there. I'll name a couple of examples. California has had a normal retirement age of 55, and it is going up to 60. Keep in mind, in Minnesota, our normal retirement age is 66 and has been that for over 20 years. Illinois moved their normal retirement age from age 60 to 67. But again, they're doing it only for new hires, newly hired employees. Pennsylvania moved its normal retirement age from 60 to 65, just done recently. They have a 35 and out provision, and they've replaced that. 35 and out means after 35 years of service, you can get full benefits with no reduction for early retirement. They're moving to a rule of 92, meaning the age plus years of service equal 92. They can retire early. In contrast, Minnesota has had a rule of 90, but it was eliminated in 1989. So they're really three-quarters or so of our active employees have no rule of 90 and an age 66 normal retirement age. So those are just a couple of examples. New hybrid plans were added in Michigan and Utah. They're fairly complicated, but they were added. The number of states looked at lowering their investment return assumption. This is something that you spoke, this committee discussed earlier at the first part of this hearing with Mr. Bicker and Bergstrom, and so a number of other states are looking at. And there were several that did benefit studies. So that's just a snapshot. We're not the only state, obviously, that has been hurt by the market downturn. And I think what characterizes us somewhat differently from other states is that We have a more modest benefit structure to begin with, and we also acted fairly promptly to take care of the financial problems we were facing last year. So slide 23, just to start to wrap up. Minnesota has been, as I said, far more conservative, I think, and modest in the benefit levels it's provided compared to other states. The legislature really has been very good about and disciplined about attending to our financial needs and addressing problems when they occur. And in fact, I think MMB will tell you, those who meet with our bond rating agencies, they have been very impressed, particularly last year, with what we did to take care of our benefit liabilities and our financial issues, and that has reflected very positively in our bond rating. We have modest benefit levels compared to other states. We spend, our public employer contributions represent about 1.6% of total state and local government spending, and that compares to 2.9% for other states. The average multiplier in other states is 1.94%, the multiplier for our benefit formula. And in Minnesota, it is 1.7, so lower for PARA and MSRS. And for TRA, we're slightly higher starting in 2006 at 1.9, but nonetheless under the average. And again, we've been proactive about our benefit changes. Our post fund was a problem in terms of the increases that were paid to retirees in the late 90s and early late 90s. They were high. That problem was addressed. The legislature took action. The post fund was eliminated, and those increases no longer can occur, really. And as I mentioned, we're at age 66, normal retirement age, and the rule of 90 was eliminated well over 20 years ago. So I'll just end here to say on page 24 that we are facing a lawsuit with respect to the changes in retiree annual adjustments. It's a lawsuit has been filed. It is not it's not a class action suit at this point. It could be, but it isn't at this point. Our position, the state's position, we're being represented by the Attorney General's office. We have briefed the issue, and those briefs are all public out on the court's websites. And we have asked for summary judgment. There will be a hearing on March 22nd, and we expect a decision from the judge sometime in the summer, although it's likely the decision is going to be appealed. We don't know that for certain, but it probably will be. And there are two other states, Colorado and South Dakota, which are facing the similar lawsuits. Same law firm brought the lawsuits. We are ahead of those other two states in terms of the legal proceedings of the timeline, so we are awaiting that. The benefit design study that was mandated by the 2010 legislation asked the systems to analyze defined benefit, defined contribution, and alternative designs. That report is due back to the Pension Commission on June 1. We have held a couple of public stakeholder meetings for our membership and anyone in the public who is interested in learning about the study. And we've gotten, you know, input and suggestions. We are in the process now of getting some actuarial cost estimates done, and we hope that those numbers will be available by the end of March, early April. That's at least the schedule that we are on. At that point, we are planning to actually float a draft of the study, a preliminary draft, float it, meaning make it public, and really take in any input and comment from stakeholder groups and others that want to do that before we finalize the report for the June 1 date. So I think that
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, one of the questions I was going to ask, I think you've already, maybe you've kind of, you said in your last slide there about a class action lawsuit, and then you said you're anticipating that it might be a class action lawsuit. So that was one question that I was going to ask, if there was if it was a class action, when did it become one? But you're just anticipating that it might be. Is that correct?
Yeah, I apologize. I'm not an attorney, but it is a lawsuit at this point. The class has not been certified, and that may or may not happen. So that's if that helps.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. And follow-up question, Ms. Hacking, I take it that we've had other similar type actions in the past where there's been lawsuits have been filed against the state regarding this. I'm just wondering how the state has come out in previous lawsuits.
Ms. Hacking.
Thank you. Actually, the case law in Minnesota is pretty old. The most significant case dates back well over 20 years. So this case will be very significant in terms of precedent it may set and the ground that it'll break. There are some previous suits, but nothing quite on point. So we don't have a lot of recent guidance from the courts about how we can change our benefits.
Thank you.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Hacking, I've got two sets of questions. One about the lawsuit simply. Suppose this doesn't go well for us, that the provisions we made for these retiree reduction in benefits doesn't go well for us. Can you put a cost on that, and have we done anything to sort of prepare ourselves for what happens if this turns out not to support the legislation that was passed?
Ms. Hacking.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it would have a very significant effect on the savings. Most of the savings that I detailed for you, the $5.9 billion, is a good share of it is from this particular lawsuit, which focuses on the annual retiree adjustments. The suit is only on that piece of our change, not the other changes that we made. But that, nonetheless, that's the most significant piece.
We don't have a number on that?
Not off the top of my head. It's in our actuarial reports.
Here? Okay.
Yeah. My guess is it's roughly three-quarters. It's very significant of the cost, and we can get you more precise figures.
All right.
In terms of preparing for it, to your other question, we really kind of have to wait and see what the judge's opinion is and also ultimately what the disposition of this case is, because if we, for example, lose at the initial stage, very likely we would appeal. And so it's going to be a while before we know one way or the other what the status is. And once we do, we expect we'd have some guidance about what is possible. We would be coming back to the legislature to engage in some discussion about what changes we would need to make. There will be time, and it's kind of hard to anticipate exactly what the decision will be.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Hacking. And this may be a broader question for the other directors here as well. Regarding the pension alternative study, so far as I understand it, you've received basically information that helps you with the design of the study that you're going to do. Have you learned anything so far? Are there any results that you could share with the committee at this point? And to go along with that, at what point will the actuarial study be? It sounds like you have the actual study going to be ready, or the preliminary study will be ready March 31. Did I understand that number correctly? And I mean, the sooner we have that to address any remaining issues that might be in the pension in pension reform, I think the better. Forgive me, I'm a little impatient on this. I'd like to have it. I'd like to have it just as soon as we could. Can you give us, like, just in terms of the actuarial report, how soon might that be available to us?
Ms. Hacking.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we've asked our actuary to plan to have it to us by the end of March, and we are hoping that they will stay on track with that. We haven't been sitting on our hands. The evaluations were finalized at the end of December, but now we've gone through a one-month period where the Pension Commission's actuary audits our valuations, and that's there's a lot of going back and forth. The Pension Commission has to sort of verify and be comfortable that the basis for doing cost studies, the defined contribution, defined benefit cost, that the basis is accurate. So we're still in that process of making sure those numbers are tied down and that there's agreement among the actuaries. So they'll be turning to this study very soon, and again, we've given them that timeline of late March to get us the information.
Just one last follow-up, please, Mr. Chairman. I realize we have a busy schedule. Within that actuarial study, will there be any consideration of the return, the expected return on the assets that you have going forward, that by which we use to measure our unfunded liability? I understand the number for many of our plans is 8.5%. Will there be some consideration of the impact of maybe that number moving up or down from there over the next 20 years?
Ms. Hacking?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that the impact of changing the 8.5% assumption to something lower is something that we have analyzed and recently have been providing the Pension Commission staff with some estimates that we've done of that. So that is something that is available. As to how it enters into the study, it's a little hard for me to say at this point because we haven't gotten to the actual financial numbers yet, but the pure impact, for example, we've been asked of lowering the 8.5% assumption, let's say, to 8, that has been analyzed by the systems, and we're providing those numbers to the pension.
Are those available to us?
Representative Banning.
Sorry, I apologize. Yeah. Are those available to us?
We can certainly make it available. I think the Pension Commission staff may still be collecting it. I'm not sure that they have it all yet.
Well,
but what we have, we can provide.
I'm highly motivated to receive those numbers. Thank you.
Representative Kahn, and then we have to move on in order to get the rest of our agenda accomplished here. Representative Kahn. Representative Kahn, would you use your mic, please?
Yes. I noticed in your list of testifiers that, your list of state comparisons, one of the ones that I didn't see on any list was Oregon, and I do understand that they have a complicated system, which I think could be of interest to us, with a proportion of the pension being a defined benefit, and then a portion also being available as a defined contribution. Is that anything that anyone has looked at here?
Ms. Hacking?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I have not looked at it recently, but we certainly can provide you. Perhaps Oregon wasn't on the list.
Because they didn't change anything.
We were looking sort of at the 2010 window, but we can get you information about Oregon.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for coming back and for all the good information you supplied us, and you can tell this committee is very interested in your work and the challenges we face with our pensions. We will now move back to the Office of Enterprise Technology to pick up where we left off yesterday. And members, we have Representative Kahn's bill that we have to dispose of and act on today.
Good.
I thought that would get your attention. It's a good bill.
Yes. I think the chair is a co-author.
And so we're going to have to... Ms. Schlatteroff and your colleagues, I would say by quarter two or thereabouts, we're going to have to move on to consider that bill. Ms. Schlatteroff, welcome back.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thanks for the opportunity to come back and close a couple issues as well as conclude our comments. The last item, as you remember, in terms of our presentation from yesterday, is that we were going to talk about enterprise email. In terms of our agenda, sorry about that. Sincerely apologize. Okay, in terms of our agenda, we're going to, again, clean up a couple items from yesterday, very briefly, talk about technology services, specifically enterprise email, and then make some closing comments. So yesterday you asked, there's a question about Department of Revenue, specifically a project that we started with the Department of Revenue about 3 years ago regarding our data center services that we discontinued. I made a comment. I agreed with the comments from the representative as stated, and again, want to reiterate that we serve our customers. If we provide a service that is not working for them, we didn't want to continue it and expend dollars that didn't need to be expended. We sort of rolled back things, and now we're restarting our data center project in a very different way, and Department of Revenue continues to be a very active participant in the overall planning as well as eventual delivery of that project. I also wanted to provide for context, just again to remind you, we talked about utility services, the services that everyone has to consume, as well as market services, which are services that people consume at will. Regarding our data center services, I wanted to make sure that I was clear about the fact that we have a number of market-based data center customers today who all opt to use our data center services by choice. So here's a list of all of our customers. I don't know if you can see them, but it's wide, both within state government, other public sector entities. So it's a wide list of customers. All of these services, nearly all of these services, are provided on fifth floor of the Centennial Office Building. Again, a retrofitted office space. So all these folks, either in whole or part, obtain their data center services from the Office of Enterprise Technology. Another question that was asked was about service evaluation. How do we make the decision that we're going to pursue a different approach about services? How do we evaluate if they're market-based, if they're competitive, if they're doing well? And I want to talk a little bit about that. Just in terms of a reminder, we have an enterprise governance process that we utilize. It engages, again, financial, IT, and business to make decisions to serve the enterprise. One thing that we didn't talk about, we talked yesterday a little bit about governance in terms of their subcommittees. CIOs representing 23 agencies make recommendations, again, to CFOs, deputy commissioners, as well as CIOs, who then make recommendations to the commissioners and onto the governor's office. We did not talk about the service strategy team, which is off to the side of this chart. I want to introduce right now our assistant commissioner, director of customer service, Tarek Tomes, who's in charge of this area, and he's going to talk a little bit about how we make, what the role is of the service strategy team, and how we make decisions. I also want to say that the decisions that we make, as you can see from governance, roll over to MMB, who by statute has to sign off on our rates every year. So that's another check and balances in terms of our rates. But again, Tarek Tomes.
Representative Leidiger, did you have a question for Mr.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, just briefly. It says cities here on as one of your customers. How many cities? What's the scope there, please?
Ms. Schlatteroff?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm going to let, again, Tarek Tomes answer that question as
okay.
well.
Mr. Tomes, welcome, and please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Tarek Tomes. I'm an assistant commissioner for the Office of Enterprise Technology, responsible for the Customer and Service Management Division. Mr. Chairman, members, the scope of services from a data center perspective that we provide to cities from a customer base perspective is actually quite small, numbering just a handful of cities that receive our data center services from us.
Thank you.
Mr. Tomes, proceed.
Thank you. Just a little bit of background as it relates to governance and some foundational elements related to how we deliver services and the service strategies that go into our overall service model. The service strategy team is a cross-customer governance group that helps us as it relates to service strategy, really serves as a really critical customer feedback mechanism related to the services that we render, both from a performance, price, market entry, market exit. We present the service strategy team with a lot of information related to roadmap, direction, where we're going from a service perspective. The slide on page 7 just gives a broad overview of our service review process, which is really a foundational process for us as it relates to how we view the services that we deliver from a maturity perspective as well as from a really important delivery perspective. We have a number of steps that we go through as it relates to all of our services. We go through these steps at a minimum on a yearly basis as it relates to our annual rate setting process that's approved by the Office of Management and Budget. But we also go through many of these steps more frequently depending on certain criteria. From a trigger for service review perspective, like I just mentioned, certainly the annual rate setting process is an automatic trigger where we review how we deliver services and are there more effective ways to deliver those services. New events or changes in service requirements, if potentially a different business requirement illustrated that would cause a larger change from a service perspective, a need for a large capital investment in a service space. Ongoing modernization, information technology is a space that continually changes and evolves, and the need to modernize critical mission-critical business systems is an ongoing information technology need. And an opportunity for better price points and improved service delivery as our information technology space in the broader sense continues to change with the evolution of many cloud-based service offerings. We certainly continue to evaluate market opportunities to deliver services more effectively. From a requirements perspective, we review service levels, we review information related to cost analysis, we scan the marketplace for the services that we provide to make sure that we understand where the services that we deliver compare from a market perspective. We do a constant review of provider options as it relates to these critical services, both from an internal and external perspective. The market review of our services really is done from a multifaceted perspective, from a number of different angles. We review the market as it relates to public sector. What do other states do? How do other states deliver? What are the cost points for delivery of services from other states? What does the market in general do? What does the market look like for the delivery of these services? And then what is the cost point for our customers to deliver these services individually? And is there an opportunity where a shared services model is more effective for us and our customers? From a business case perspective, once we navigate down that road, we look at returns on investment. We look at the various security and regulatory requirements from HIPAA requirements in the healthcare industry to CJIS requirements in the public safety space to the important SEC or IRS compliance regulatory requirements from a revenue perspective potentially. And then we move forward with potential sourcing opportunities or options as it relates to services. And we do this, again, on an ongoing basis, at a minimum every year, but certainly whenever significant triggers are necessitated. There was a question yesterday that we wanted to just provide a little bit of context around or a little bit more information regarding utility services and how do services become utility services and what defines or makes up a utility service. With the service strategy team, we have a formal definition for a utility service that we worked through together with our customers. It's a relatively generic definition that really just sets the scope and boundaries for those types of technology services that eventually be yielded best by a centralized delivery from a service perspective. Key attributes of this utility service definition are the ability to standardize feature sets, so basically not the need to have a really super customized environment for a particular application set. Efficient delivery, the ability to deliver the services efficiently and quickly with the agility necessary for our customers. The ability from a cost perspective to minimize the need for large capital expenditures to get into the space and have incremental costs based on the capacity that's necessitated. And most importantly, or certainly very significant, is financial transparency, the ability to financially illustrate the cost makeup of a service, those costs that directly from a direct and indirect perspective that go into the cost buildup. One of the services that next slide, sir. One of the service areas that we're really excited about, as it relates to service delivery, that I think kind of illustrates a few of the slides that we've gone through, is our enterprise unified and communication, unified communication collaboration space. The unified communication collaboration space really is both an infrastructure and a strategy to provide an ability for public sector employees to communicate and collaborate more efficiently, to provide the tools necessary to have the ability to connect to those constituents that need communication and collaboration in the most efficient and effective manner possible. In this particular instance, the unified communication and collaboration space really is made up of 3 to 4 broad technologies. Email from a messaging perspective, which includes calendaring, web collaboration, the ability to share documents, to share content, and share important information, and broader conferencing technologies that bring multiple people together to communicate more effectively. One of the pillars of this service that we have been delivering now for a little bit over 2 years is the Enterprise Email Service. The Enterprise Email Service is a service that's rendered centrally by the Office of Enterprise Technology, primarily to the executive branch. Does have a customer base outside of the executive branch as well. The total number of mailboxes, just a few metrics to provide some dimension to this particular service space. The total number of mailboxes that are supported are a little bit over 38,000 mailboxes. We support a little bit over 2,400 mobile devices of different makes and manufacturers. From a messaging perspective, our users send about 250,000 messages a day, receive about 825,000 messages a day. From an availability delivery perspective, the last 12-month average from a delivery perspective is 99.9%, actually 99.93% from an availability perspective. We process and receive as a state 275 million messages a month. Of the 275 million messages a month that are destined for the address space that we provide services for, 96.5% of those messages are discarded because they're spam or virus from a content perspective. We publish metrics in this space on a monthly basis. Some of the enterprise email benefits for our customers, as well as for the state as a whole, cost avoidance, the ability to avoid the ongoing cost of managing, upgrading, maintaining 36 separate email systems with multiple disparate vendors and makes of platforms. Better security, the ability to secure one messaging platform and make sure that it meets all of the regulatory and security requirements for our state. And better security, the ability to have a single directory, calendaring, collaboration facility where people have the ability to contact and reach out without the boundaries of disparate systems. From a timeline perspective, just wanted to give a little bit of where we came from and where we're going as it relates to this particular critical service space. In 2007, really largely as a result of the Drive to Excellence initiative, there was an RFP initiated, cross-collaboration with our customers. There was an RFP initiated, which was scored with our customer base, related to the standardization on an email platform, so a little bit of a architecture role related to picking one particular platform for messaging services, and also there was a component to it to delivery of services. So in 2007, the Microsoft email platform, Microsoft Exchange as an email platform, was selected as the messaging platform. In 2008, email was declared a utility service within the executive branch, which initiated a project to consolidate those 30 disparate messaging platforms into one. Shortly thereafter, the enterprise email platform was created, was built. In 2009, the migration started with our first agencies. We had a pilot group of agencies. It was 5 agencies or so that were the first initial pilots. In the latter half of 2009, we entered into a larger licensing agreement with Microsoft related to the licenses required to run both the messaging platforms as well as the productivity tools that are used on many of the desktops within the executive branch. This really provided a tremendous opportunity as that particular licensing arrangement was typically conducted separately. So by aggregating the licensing volume into one, there were relatively large economies of scale that were realized there. And then at the later half of, we just recently completed the full migration of the entire executive branch, which yielded approximately the 35,000 users. So additional UCC milestones moving forward. SharePoint, which is the collaboration end of the web collaboration end of the Enterprise Utility and Communication Collaboration Service, was declared a utility service on the tail end of 2010. And we, shortly thereafter, with a significant trigger in additional volume from a service perspective, the need for building additional infrastructure and capacity, went back to that service review process as to how we deliver services and is there a more effective way to deliver services. The declaration of a utility service typically will mean that you have to accommodate more larger volumes of users for your particular service area, which could yield an investment in additional capital expenditures. With that, we moved forward from a service strategy perspective to, we were the first state in the United States to move our services, announce a service agreement to move our services, the unified communication and collaboration space, to the proverbial cloud, and signing an agreement with Microsoft for their business productivity online software suite of tools. Subsequently, shortly thereafter, there have been a number of other significant announcements in this space as it relates to cloud-based services. The state of California, New York City, U.S. Department of Agriculture, the state of Arizona, Montana, other states are also moving in that same direction. Just in terms of a little bit of benefit as it relates to cloud computing in general in this particular space and how that can help, on-premise challenges, and these are challenges that we as a service provider, as a central service provider have, but certainly the larger customer base, I think we share these common challenges. Operating expenses, the need to back up and patch and maintain all the different servers. In a cloud-based opportunity, those types of maintenance activities the cloud provider assumes. The initial capital expenses in hardware, the professional technical services to build these environments. Cloud-based opportunities, in particular in this particular service space, really provide you with what we refer to as a CapEx-free computing mechanism, where you consume the capacity that you need. You need less capacity, you consume less capacity. If you need more capacity, then you have an ability to elastically expand that cloud offering to assume additional capacity. The capacity from a on-premise provider is typically fixed. We certainly face that. We try to build our systems and platforms to the demand that currently exists to keep the cost as small as possible, which means when there are larger aggregation opportunities, when there are opportunities in our broader customer space that are made available to us, then investment in capital expenditure to expand that capacity is necessitated. The cloud opportunity in this particular space really gives us on-demand capacity and ability to expand as necessary. The agreement that we entered into provides us with an ability to provide that particular suite of services, that unified communication and collaboration, email, web collaboration set of services, to all customers that are within our statute. Then last but not least, the periodic hardware and software refresh. When we created our enterprise messaging service just 2 years ago, it was a brand new platform. 2 years later, 35,000 users onboarded later, there's already a new version. Typically from our vendors, there are new versions every 2 to 3 years. So the ability to stay modern and have a modernization aspect built into it without the need for capital or professional services to expand those environments is a part of this cloud opportunity.
Mr. Chair, committee members, just in terms of concluding comments, I just want to transition back to close. This is one of the issues that you asked, is how are we doing regarding delivery of our mission that was created when 16E was created almost 5 years ago. I just want to check in on a couple of key issues. Regarding standards and policies, we have come a long way since the original statute was passed. Our security office is objectively viewed as one of the best in the country. We routinely provide information to other states on how we're doing regarding security. Architecture standards is quickly developing. We're making things be more standardized, which is saving costs. The uniformity drives different kind of opportunities for us. hardware and software standards have avoided $148 million in cost to date. That's from purchasing off our hardware and standards contracts, K-12. That includes K-12 cost avoidance and portfolio management and approval regarding our major project sign-off is sort of the next generation of how we're looking at standards and policies. Regarding service delivery, 2 years ago, we didn't have a customer service unit. The conversation, the comments that Tarek's sharing, they didn't exist. We didn't do those kinds of comparisons. We didn't separate. We didn't have a clear way to separate our expenses from our revenues. We didn't have the cost model that we have today that does that. We didn't bill out our hours like we do today. 3 years ago, we didn't have governance. We didn't have a way to intersect with customers. They came to us, asked us for service, and we built out those services, not always knowing the volumes to actually sustain the service, not really developing key business principles about how we were going to deliver that service. I think that the fact that we have utility services, that we're functioning, have a high-functioning governance unit, and we're moving together in several different areas is a huge credit to how we have succeeded or not succeeded. Also, the fact that we sustain a $100 million budget and we're a market-based service. Certainly, there was a time when we thought several of our big customers were going to leave us, and we had to respond to the threat of them and up the ante in terms of how we delivered our service. We have maintained that dollar amount in terms of our budget, despite the fact they all have substantial pressures on their budgets and are always cutting costs and figuring out ways to drive out greater results with every dollar that they spend with us. I also want to say that the two areas, it was strategic that we picked data center services as well as enterprise email. We did that for the executive branch for sure, but a comment that we make routinely is you have to have power for your computing services. And you have to have a way to communicate. Email today is as important as using the toilets in terms of people doing their work. We picked those services because we wanted to make sure that we did them well with the enterprise, with the executive branch, because it's a platform for us to look at other market opportunities with our other public sector partners, which includes counties and cities, and certainly they've talked to us about other partnership opportunities. So could we do more? For sure. I think the fact that we have a new CIO, she'll bring a new way of looking at how we deliver services. She'll have her own ideas. I know that she's very keen on a mobile workforce, figuring out how we can use personal devices, figure out how we do things differently in terms of deliver baseline computing services. I think there's all kinds of opportunities for us to leverage our purchasing in different ways. I'm proud of the work that we've done so far. I think we as a team feel proud, but there's a lot more that we can do in the future, and we're looking forward to doing that as well. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Schlatteroff and Mr. Tomes. Obviously, a lot of good progress has been made, and there are lots of opportunities yet ahead of us. And this is probably not the kind of operation that you're going to have a clear end date, that as time goes on, you're going to discover new ways of doing things that can help state government. Is that the way you would see it?
Mr. Chair, committee members, absolutely. Technology is constantly evolving.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Appreciate your coming back again today.
Thank you.
We will now turn to Representative Kahn's bill. Representative Kahn, welcome.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you very much. I'm not quite sure what kind of a motion. Maybe when I finish, I would move that House file 110 be recommended to pass. The question the committee can think about is should it go to Ways and Means or right to the floor, because there is a rule.
Representative Kahn, because there is a slight cost, not much, very slight cost, Mr. Shepherd indicates that some people may feel that should go through Ways and Means. So, even though we don't have a hard and fast rule about that, perhaps we ought to just refer it on to Ways and Means.
Let me talk about what the cost is. But there is the rule specifically says that unless a bill has a negligible fiscal impact, and I think I can make the argument that this bill has a negligible fiscal impact. But let me do that, and then I'll make a suggestion of what to do. House File 110 adds, and all of you people have very carefully listened to all the information that we have about pensions. The problem is the people who fully understand pensions, and it usually takes them a while to understand it, are the members of the Pension Commission. We only have 5 members from each body on the Pension Commission. One of the real problems is that there's only in no matter what the ratios of minority to majority have been, we've only had 1 minority member from the House and 1 from the Senate on the Pension Commission. I feel very comfortable presenting this bill in the minority because I have consistently presented it over the years in the majority. The House position, which has usually been in committee, Pension Commission, on the in this committee and on the floor, the House members have always supported it. The Senate has not, and the interesting difference is that the members of the conference committee and the commission are always the same, and the 2 members of the Senate who did support this position were reelected, and the 3 members of the Senate who didn't support it were not elected. I don't believe it was an issue in their election. I just think it reflects on their general judgment on issues in general. But the for the fiscal impact of this bill, you have a preliminary fiscal note in your bill, which says that the total cost, because you're adding 4 members, you're increasing the membership by 40%. So that's an increase of the expense of the legislative members. The fiscal note that we got said 3,000. The commission had given me a number of 4,000, preliminary number of 4,000. I'll point out that the Legislative Commission on LCPR budget is just about 500,000. So we're looking at something significantly less than 1% of that budget. It's also part of the general that budget is set by the Legislative Coordinating Commission. That budget is $15.1 million per year, which includes that, so it's a totally a negligible percentage of that total number. My suggestion, looking at these tiny numbers, which are the smallest numbers I think you'll ever see before you for any issue that comes before this, is my suggestion would be to pass it to the floor, but before it gets there, to discuss it with the chair of Ways. The chair here to discuss it with the chair of Ways and Means and see if she wants to see it and send it there. If you note, this bill has an effective immediately clause and also a clause saying that the additional appointments have to be made within 10 days. It would be really nice to have these people on right away learning about pensions and doing it. So that's just my suggestion. I don't know, Mr. Chairman, what you would like to do.
Okay, well, we're going to go check with the Chair of Ways and Means right now to see if she wants to see the bill or not. So, discussion to the bill. Or questions for the Representative Kahn? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn, I don't sit on this, haven't sat on this commission. But I'd just like to know from your experience of the Senate always repealing or I should say rebuffing you and allowing this to go forward, what's their main concern?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I think it's a difference in philosophy between the Senate and the House. The House kind of believes in more participation, and the Senate kind of believes in more control. And that was shown by the control of the chair of the Senate, of the Pension Commission, from the Senate, who had total control over three members. And I had at least one of those members saying that maybe in the future, of course she's not back here now, for the future she could support it, but this time she had to support her chair. So I think that's the reason. And I guess I said this to Gov Operations. It's a standard. It's an example to show you how compromise is not always the best thing to do. Is that one time when the House passed it in conference committee, we compromised on the number 6 between the 5 and the 7. 6 turns out to be the worst possible number because it made it more difficult to get a quorum. Whereas 7 makes it easier to get a quorum. And it is often a problem to get a quorum. It's one of the problems. The Pension Commission is important enough that I think it ought to have a set time in the legislative schedule to meet. Because it's very hard. Well, speak to the chair, former chair of the Pension Commission, Representative Murphy, about the difficulty of finding the time, particularly near the end of the session when the kind of bills are all in place. There are ways to change the operations and to fix that up. But
Is there anyone in the audience, or Representative Winkler?
Chair, Representative Kahn, has there ever been discussion of changing the format of the Pension Commission from a commission to a joint standing committee that could actually have jurisdiction over bills and begin the process and have bill referrals to the Pension Commission, to a joint pension committee?
Representative Kahn?
Not that I can remember. I don't think so. I think the thought is that that might even remove a layer of, I think that the commission pretty well acts like a joint committee, and it always goes then to GovOp and state government. Well, sometimes pension bills don't have financial impact, and then they can go from GovOp to the floor. But more recently, I can say I don't like to claim all kinds of credits for great improvements I've made to the legislature, but one of the most important ones I ever made, besides the smoking rules, was the fact that we used to deal with every pension bill individually. And when I got on the Pension Commission, and you wouldn't believe the amount of time that took on the House floor. And when I got on the Pension Commission, I originated the idea of omnibus pension. I think maybe when I chaired GovOp, I made them all an omnibus pension bill. And that's saved us an enormous amount of time. Plus the fact that it focuses attention on pensions at one point, as opposed to all these little bills that aren't kind of important enough to look at, but the whole aspect is pretty important.
Mr. Drake, the only thing I would suggest is that we have bills that have come through GovOp so far that have a pension impact, and yet there's no mechanism for referring them to a committee for review. It's similar when I had the Iran divestment bill. You couldn't ever refer it to the Pension Commission for a hearing. You could wait and say that we're not going to take it up until we get a recommendation from the Pension Commission. But it just seems to me that, much like all rulemaking bills have to go to GovOps, there should be some mechanism for the commission to have jurisdiction over a bill, so that we make sure that not just pension bills, but bills affecting pensions have that review.
I don't think it's been much of a problem in the past. Again, Representative Murphy can, I think they've pretty much gone there. Let me just say something about, maybe not the new members know, but most people know that Representative Greiling is clearly one of the smartest people in the House. And she and I were both appointed to the Pension Commission for the first time at the same time when D. Long was the House Speaker. And we were both sitting, interacting in the meetings of the Pension Commission. And it must be that I'm a better bluffer than she is, because suddenly towards the end of that session, I asked a really stupid, we were really hanging on by our fingernails trying to learn this stuff. I asked some really stupid question, and Mindy told me she was so relieved because it showed her that I really didn't understand it any better than she did. I was just faking it better than she was. So, anyway, you know, hopefully I'm a little better at it now, but it is a difficult issue. And we do need more people, and particularly the thought that one person would have to explain it to the, you know, without any of the kind of conversations that at least we could have in our caucus to the minority caucus is, you know, just not a good idea.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to be heard either for or against this bill? Anyone who wishes to be heard? If not, Representative Kahn, a word we have is that it needs to go to Ways and Means. And so would you renew your motion?
House File 110 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you. All in favor of the bill, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The bill will now go to Ways and Means. Members, just to let you know about next week, on Tuesday we have the Banyan bill, House File 2, and the Pepin bill, 173. On Wednesday we're going to hear an overview of the Arts Board, Historical Society, and also the workforce report that we wanted to make sure we had on our agenda. And then on Thursday, right now, the Downey bill, House File 4, is scheduled to be heard. I want you to be thinking about the Historical Society has invited us to take a Cook's tour of the History Center, which if you've never done that, you really should. And we're looking at either Tuesday, probably an evening, like 5, 6 o'clock, something like that, on March 1st or March 8th. So why don't you think about that, and we'll talk about that next week as to whether you would like to see us schedule that tour. So with that, we did the minutes, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just quickly, the Legacy Committee was also thinking of taking a history tour,
okay,
and perhaps we could coordinate, go together.
Sure.
Especially since
I want to go twice.
Three of us don't want to go twice.
Good suggestion. Meeting adjourned.